It's our privilege to study the book of Nehemiah. And I hope you'll... Let me see if I got the right one here. We're making our way right to the end here. I'm talking about be diligent, right? If you want a great example of someone who's diligent in Scripture, Nehemiah's your guy. He's a great example of someone who's able to really stay at a task and yet we often get really focused on the man himself and we miss the theological import of the passage. So I'll try to apply it to the idea of being diligent, but also not keep our focus only on Nehemiah himself. When I think of this book, I think of this question of how much have others done for you? You've heard of the self-made man, the self-made woman. Isn't that a bizarre concept? The self-made man. Did you know the self-made man had someone else changing his diapers for the first 2 or 3 years of his life? The self-made woman didn't teach herself how to walk or talk or, you know, of all the various people compared to people and animals, you know, humans are about the most dependent. You ever thought about that? When a deer is born, a deer walks within an hour. So a deer can walk within an hour, teach himself to walk and feed himself and all that. If you can walk, you can pretty much feed yourself, right? You just go walk around and find food. But a human, you don't even walk till you're about a year old. You know, we are really quite dependent. We're dependent on others, and other people do an awful lot for us. I never realized how much my parents did for me until I had a baby. And I thought, this baby can't even focus on me for a few weeks, you know? And now it's the same with my grandson. I actually haven't looked eye to eye with my grandson because I've only been with him for the first 2 or 3 weeks of his life. So when we go back to the U.S. in a couple of weeks, it'll be like meeting him for the first time because he'll have eye contact with me, you know? And... you know, it's a very, very important thing to be grateful to people who have done a lot for you. I hope you do that with your parents. Whenever I see my mother, I try to make a point to really thank her for all that she's done for me. Because there's nobody who's invested more in me than my mother during the, you know, developmental years of our life. And, you know, think about what God has done for you. None of us can overestimate what God has done. We all underrate what the Lord has done for us to help us, to restore us. I bet you've probably been in the hospital during your life, right? And God's used doctors, God's used medicine. I'm walking here. I just walked up these 3 flights of stairs because of Dr. Black. You never heard of Dr. Black, but he put my leg back together when I broke my ankle when I was 14 years old, doing something really stupid, like tobogganing down the slope, the front of a ski slope. It's not meant for toboggans, it's for skis, but I did a really stupid thing. I ended up breaking my leg and all of it. But I'm grateful that the Lord provided this doctor who really knew what he was doing, put me back together, so I think of him every day. When I stand on 1 foot, you know, put my shoes on or whatever, you know, take a shower or whatever. And I think, oh, yeah, Lord, thanks for Dr. Black. That was a long time ago. But we should have that sense of gratitude. We should be exuding gratitude, don't you think? Especially to God. What has God done for us? And how should you respond to God's faithfulness to restore you? I know you say, well, you should be grateful, right? You should, with all of the disobedience and wrath and sin and judgment, the Lord caused the people to get their attention to focus back on Him, how He used Ezekiel, Daniel, to help preserve the people while they were away from the land. I mean, that's a lot to be thankful to the Lord for bringing the people back. So in our post-exilic era, just to sum up again, to remind us, it was the Assyrians that scattered the people in the northern kingdom, but a lot of those people from the northern kingdom had already made their way down to Judah, and they were living in Judah. So when the Babylonians brought the people out of Judah in exile, they were actually bringing people from the northern kingdom with them. And God was faithful to preserve the people. He was preserving them because the Messiah was long prophesied to appear through the tribe of Judah. And so the Lord raised up the right people to do the job. We've already gone through Zerubbabel, who helped them rebuild the temple, and Ezra to teach the law of the Lord. And now it's time to talk about Nehemiah. Nehemiah was a man who really had a cushy life, to be honest. Over there in Babylon, working for the king. I mean, most people, when they are in a situation like that, they just think about themselves and their life of luxury and all that kind of thing. But Nehemiah was the N of the Zen, the three diplomat priests. And he knew about what had happened that Ezra talks about the return of the people to the land. And we don't have any record of him being in the land of Israel, actually. I presume we're talking 100 years after the restoration to the land. And I presume he was born over in Susa during the Persian era, and he grew up, but he still had a tie to the land. He knew about Ezra returning to the land, but I hadn't really thought about it till right now, but had Nehemiah actually ever been to Israel? He knew that the temple was rebuilt. He knew that the life had been revived there in the land under Ezra, who was living during his same time. And yet he seems to really identify with his people in their land, perhaps having never been there before. He recognizes in the third verse of the book that the remnant was small and reproached, and the walls were ruined. He says here, when Hanani, one of his brothers, came from Judah, hey, how are they doing? And they said to me, those who survived the exile and are back in the province are in great trouble and disgrace. So some have survived. There's just a small remnant, but they're reproached. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates have been burned with fire. We find earlier, under Ezra says that they were actually building the walls. But were they? Or is that... He's just quoting one of those opposing the Jews, saying, hey, these guys are going to rebuild the walls. And you know what? If those walls of Jerusalem get rebuilt, interests of the king are not going to be kept. The city's going to rise up and revolt against you. It's like, king, you have an interest in those walls being broken down. So why would the king Artaxerxes that Nehemiah is talking about, why would he have an interest in them rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem? Why would Nehemiah have an interest? Presumably never been there before. Actually, honestly, I hadn't really thought about these these two concepts until right now. And I've taught on Nehemiah a lot. We went through it. I preached through Nehemiah twice. But there's a lot here. And I see people as they preach through Nehemiah, there's a real focus on the man Nehemiah. You can see Swindoll, hand me another brick. Beth Coppedidge, is that what? I don't know, can't see her full name. There's a lot of this emphasis on the man Nehemiah and looking at him. Even a study of Nehemiah for coaches, you know? Oh, yeah, you're a coach. Look at Nehemiah. Get the principles of good coaching. This is Nehemiah. I don't know how tall he was, but he was the walls. If he was really knee high, he'd be a little midget, right? You know, a little pygmy kind of one. But he was a big man in the eyes of God, and yet sometimes I think we make him too big. We make him the real emphasis of the book. Now, granted, it's named after him. He's certainly a big person in the book, but who's really the real hero of the book? I mean, is it Nehemiah himself or is it God? Now, you know, when I ask questions like this, you're always going to go, well, the right answer's got to be God, right? But if you look at the literature that's on him, normally the focus is on Nehemiah. It's really not on God. And yet, if you look at Nehemiah carefully, you'll see that Nehemiah's focus was on God. It's as if he's over and over in the book, he's saying, don't focus on me. I'm the one, he keeps focusing on God. He calls God the God of heaven. He calls God the great and awesome God who keeps his covenant of love. This is all chapter one here. He says God listens to prayer. He graciously gave commands, decrees, laws through Moses and promised not only exile, but also return and redeem the remnant by his great strength. Most of chapter one is Nehemiah's prayer. So you don't see Nehemiah setting himself up as some example of, you know, hey, I'm the great leader and all of that. Now, I'm not saying the Bible doesn't provide good examples for us of leadership. I think it does. And I think Nehemiah would be one of those good examples. But ultimately, the Lord is the one who gets the credit. He should. And I call this book Restoring the Walls and People. But who's one that really restores the walls and people? Ultimately, it's God. It's God doing his plan, and but he uses people like Nehemiah, and like you, and like me. And so we see, in a similar sense that we saw in Ezra, Ezra's divided in half, temple people. Now we're going to divide Nehemiah in half, walls and people. If I use the language I used in Ezra, it would be hardware, software. You know, God's faithful to do his thing in terms of building the temple or building the walls, but God is also faithful in doing his thing in building us, in providing instruction. That there's a spiritual aspect of this. It's not just construction of a temple or walls, or the political dimensions or the economic dimensions. Ultimately, it's God really working in our hearts. Because we all know that, hey, you can have the temple, you can have the walls, you can have all these so-called signs of spirituality and security and economic revival and all this, but it can lead to just abject spiritual poverty. And we need God to do his work in our life to do the real renewal. So others will outline the book as return, rebuilding, renewal, and reforms. So I think that's good. We see that all along it's really God who's the subject of each of these four things. But we have a part to play, and that's why I'm asking us to think of this book in terms of the role that we play in it. Not necessarily to be exactly like Nehemiah, because we're in very different situations, but to answer this question, how should you respond to God's faithfulness to restore you? You see, the question I'm asking, it's really, how do you respond to God's work? The question is not, how can you be like Nehemiah? That's not the question in the book. The question is, how can you respond to all these wonderful things that God has done in your life? Surely He's used people in your life, and He uses Nehemiah here. Just like I said, are we grateful for those people who have invested much in our lives? There's not a single one of us has come to this point in our lives by ourselves. It's God Himself who has used other people and incidents and everything to bring us to this point. So what we'll see here in the book is there's a diligent response that Nehemiah gives, and then there's another diligent response. So our word, our key word is be diligent here in the book. And that is be diligent because God is taking the initiative. So here's the first diligence. Serve. Serve God diligently. If we see ourselves as truly the one who is blessed by God, the natural response is to want to be diligent in serving Him in response. And so the remnant responded to God's faithful restoration of Jerusalem's wall under Nehemiah by diligent service. So the idea here is not just Nehemiah. It's the whole team that has to respond to the Lord for this to happen. I mean, Nehemiah could have been the greatest leader, but if he's got disobedient people, nothing's going to happen. We've already seen that many times through the Old Testament. You've got great leaders who are called prophets, but how many people actually responded to the prophet's message? They pretty much rejected the prophets all throughout every prophetic book that we've looked at, with the exception of Jonah. And the ones who did respond were not the people of Israel. They were the people of Nineveh. So you don't even have one example of a positive response from the people of Israel, whom God says they're just stubborn. But now, when we get to Nehemiah, we see the people do respond. Finally, as we get to this last book, chronologically, of the Old Testament. But Nehemiah has to entrust himself to the Lord. And the question I think of as it relates to chapter 1 is, how can you know if God wants you to do a certain task? So God's the one's the initiator, but we also have to respond to it as well. And God gives us the information we need to do His will. I think that's a key point, because that's what He did with Nehemiah. He informed Nehemiah of Jerusalem's sad state without a wall. It wasn't Nehemiah that was making the point that the wall was broken down. It was Hanani and his brothers who said, you know, Nehemiah, the wall's broken down. And certainly Nehemiah knew his Old Testament. He knew the traditions, and he knew about the promises to Abraham that God was going to make a great nation. And He was going to give them this land from the Wadi of Egypt to the Euphrates River. And it hadn't happened yet. My guess is that Nehemiah knew about Micah, who had preached centuries earlier and said that the Messiah would be born in Bethlehem. And so he got the information he needed. God was the one to make sure that Nehemiah was informed. He does the same for you and me as well. He informs us. All of us know about different things, and it's all part of God's plan, because He has a different calling for you than He does for me. Some of you are a lot more informed about China than others. Some of you are a lot more informed about Japan or Cambodia or counseling or administration or whatever than others of us in this room. And it's all part of God informing you in a way that you need to serve Him. He also gives us the vision we need to do His will as well. Now, Nehemiah could have taken all that information and just said, wow, what a bummer, you know? And we have that happen to us all the time. We're so over-informed. oh, I've been wondering, what do I do about China, speaking of China, as I've been learning about these concentration camps going on in China among the Uyghurs. 1 million Muslims in China are in so-called re-education camps. Have you read about this? That they're pulling fingernails out of people, torturing these people. How do we respond to this kind of thing? Not every one of us can be involved in helping every single need, but I think God, in His wonderful way, gives us a vision to help in some areas. I do some things that other people don't do, and a lot of other people do some things, a lot of things that I don't do. But it all works together because God is the one who gives us the vision to do what He wants us to do. So Nehemiah just prays, and God gives him this vision to be part of the solution, to more than pray. His prayer is a wonderful prayer of confession and basically, Lord, You are big. You're going to fulfill Your promise to bring Your people back to Your land. But God also gives us a vision to serve Him today. So I wonder, what's on your heart today? You know, what's God actually informing you about and giving you a vision to do that will enable you to do what He wants you to do? And then thirdly, God gives us a position that we need to do His will. You know, you can be informed and you can have a vision to do it, but you have to see the Lord go ahead of you and give you the opportunity, give you the connections you need. Nehemiah certainly had connections. He was a cupbearer. Now you say, really, that's really a connection? He poured the king's wine? That's a connection? Well, he was, the king knew who he was. And I like what Wiersbe says about this. He says, a cupbearer was much more than our modern butler. It was a position of great responsibility and privilege. At each meal, he tested the king's wine to make sure it wasn't poisoned. A man who stood that close to the king in public had to be handsome, cultured, knowledgeable in court procedures, and able to converse with the king and advise him if asked. And since he had access to the king, the cupbearer was a man of great influence, which he could use for good or for evil. When you're there every day seeing the king, you have an opportunity, you have a position, you have a place of influence. And God gave Nehemiah that opportunity. And Nehemiah was a Jew. And Wiersbe continues that Nehemiah, a Jew, held such an important position in the palace, speaks well of his character and ability. Kind of like Daniel 1. Where God gave Daniel a similar thing. For nearly a century, the Jewish remnant had been back in their own land, and Nehemiah could have joined them, but he chose to remain in the palace. And it turned out that God had a work for him to do there that he couldn't have accomplished elsewhere. God put Nehemiah in Susa just as he had put Esther there a generation before, and just as he had put Joseph in Egypt and Daniel in Babylon. When God wants to accomplish a work, he always prepares his workers and puts them in the right places at the right time. That's you. That's me. We just need to see it. We just need to see how he's actually working. So was he in secular work? Was Nehemiah in secular work? He wasn't a full-time Jewish worker, right? Not a full-time Christian worker. These would be a full-time Jewish worker, right? Well, I like what Ravi Zechariah says. He says, we're all priests before God, and there's no such distinction as secular and sacred. In fact, the opposite of sacred is not secular. The opposite of sacred is profane. In short, no follower of Christ does secular work. We all have a sacred calling. So do you ask people that? Are you in secular work? We often say, are you in secular work or like Christian work? You should say, are you in secular work or Christian work? No, I don't think we should do that. are you in profane work or are you in sacred work? So if you frame the question that way, your Christian friend's going to go, well, I don't think I'm in profane work. I think I'm in sacred work. As an engineer, as a doctor, as a government employee, whatever that person does. It's a way we frame it that's important, isn't it? So how can you know if God wants you to do a certain task? Here's the key idea, I think, of Nehemiah 1. God gives you the information, you know, so you know the facts. God gives you the vision and the position that you need to do His will. The issue is not whether Christians or non-Christians pay your salary. That doesn't determine whether your work is sacred or secular, profane or, you know, sacred, whatever. It's not whether Christians pay the money you needed for your lunch today. It's whether you are responding to what God has for you. We've been dealing with that as a college the last 20 years or so because we've had some rethinking about the vision of Singapore Bible College. Because we used to say, we're here to train full-time Christian workers. We had a rethinking of that in the 90s. Well, what is a full-time Christian worker? Can't a doctor be a full-time Christian worker? Can't a lawyer be a full-time Christian worker? A businessman be a full-time Christian worker? We're trying to move more toward a biblical view on this. Can't a counselor be a full-time Christian worker? So anyway. So what knowledge, faith, or place of influence has God given you? And what does God want you to do with it? I think that's one of the... How does God want you to be diligent? Like Nehemiah was to be diligent because God Himself had set all this up in his life. So he had a prayer and a vision, and the king's help was granted to him. So when we see in chapter 2, we see him actually helping restore God's honor that had been lost by the temple being rebuilt, but the walls around the city was still all broken down. In other words, God was reproached. The peoples of the land would look at this and they go, well, all the cities around here in the land of Canaan, they all have walls, but Jerusalem doesn't. I guess the God of Israel is just not strong enough to have walls around his city. You know, that was certainly a reproach against God. And so Nehemiah was willing to be a foreman. In a sense, he was really taking a step down. Here's a guy used to be with the king. And God says, I want you to go to this city that's all broken down, and I want you to get your hands dirty. And so we see God restoring them in chapter 2 as well. God informs us of our sad state of affairs. He goes around and he gets to Jerusalem and he looks around and he realizes, wow. After staying there 3 days, I set out during night. And he says, I went through the valley gate, the jackal gate, dung gate, and everything was just all broken down and destroyed by fire. In other words, he wisely investigated the situation before getting started. So that's a pretty wise thing to do, you know? And God does this. God helps us to by rallying us to honor his name once again. The other people start to get the vision because God was the one who was putting on their hearts. It wasn't Nehemiah's great ability in doing this. It was God himself. He says in verse 18, I told him about the gracious hand of my God upon me and what the king has said to me. See, Nehemiah is giving credit to God. And then God defends us against potential setbacks as well. Because they say, let's start rebuilding. That the first thing happens, verse 19, it's when Sanballat the Horonite, Tobiah the Ammonite official, and Geshem the Arab heard about it, they mocked and ridiculed us. What is this you're doing? They asked. Are you rebelling against the king? And I answered them by saying, The God of heaven will give us success. We as servants will start rebuilding. But as for you, you have no share in Jerusalem or any claim or historic right to it. And, you're kind of left at the end of chapter 2. Well, what's going to happen here? He's got the king's support, but he's got all this opposition here. And now we're starting to see these various enemies. Geshem from the Arabs, Sanballat, the Samaritans that had intermarried in the north, and then the Ammonites hadn't been wiped out either. So you've got Tobiah. Three men from three different ethnic groups, they're all fighting about him and opposing him. So they just go start making fun of him. But God helps us to be sensible to overcome opposition. Again, you see how I'm trying to frame this? This is God. This is what God's doing here. And we see Nehemiah actually doing something pretty amazing in chapter 3. They are in their own geographic location. They work on the right spots on the wall. Like Eliashib, for example. He's the high priest. So would you not expect him to be most interested in the wall closest to the temple, right here in the north? Put the high priest right there. If the invading armies come in and the wall's not in good shape right next to the temple, right where Eliashib is, yeah, he's going to be pretty interested in that area, right? The people of Jericho, the sheep gate north of the temple, that's going to be a really important area. This is where they washed the sheep before they were brought on into the temple. And good to have the high priest responsible for that particular era. There's a sense of diligence here. The British humorist Jerome K. Jerome said, "I like work. It fascinates me. I can sit and look at it for hours." Yeah, that's what you'd expect of a comedian, right? You know. But Wiersbe notes, when it comes to the work of the Lord, there's no place for spectators or self-appointed advisors or critics. But there's always room for workers. Don't you think? So, God puts it on the hearts of the people to work. And he puts it on the hearts of the people to work in the right spots on the walls. It's a communal thing. It's certainly inconvenient. You got people doing stuff that they certainly weren't skilled at. Goldsmiths building walls. You know, what do goldsmiths do? Jewelers, like, these people are work with little things, but he's got these people building walls, stone walls. People were working outside of their normal areas of expertise. And yet, the whole thing ends up being complete. It ends up being reasonable. But I think God calls us to serve him in sensible ways to protect his church. It does make sense when you think about where they're actually serving on the wall. We don't have the time to get through it, but they had the whole group was working on various parts of the wall. They all had their own part to play. It's like playing your own instrument. You know, how many of you have been in an orchestra or band before? You play a musical instrument. How many of you play a musical instrument? Seriously? Not that many of you? Only about a fourth of you? Oh, the music. Yeah, the music students are gone. Yeah, but the music students have recitals right now, so I've excused the music students because they've got their other final exam kind of thing going on right now. But a lot of times I thought about what it would be like. I'm the drummer at our church, you know. I'm the third string drummer. Because our first string moved to East Timor, our second string moved to Jakarta, and now I'm left, you know. But it'd be interesting for everybody to switch instruments. I go over to the piano that my wife normally plays. She goes over to the drums, and our guitarist ends up playing, you know. It would absolutely be disastrous if everybody played somebody else's instrument. It might make the point, but I don't think people will want to come back to our church again, you know? The point is, God's gifted each one of us at different places, and we need to be it's really sensible. God helps us to be sensible to overcome the opposition. But also God helps us to be united to overcome opposition as well. And so the unity comes from all of us having a different part to play, but it all coming together. So God united all kinds of Jews to work as common laborers, which is kind of amazing. Priests, goldsmiths, a perfumer. The guy knows how to make perfume. Do you think he's going to be really great at building a wall? He was willing, and God gave him the ability to do it. Political leaders, women, men, Levites, merchants, even people who lived in other places. And the point is that they're all working together. There was a young boy who wanted to show his strength in front of the class by breaking a bunch of sticks, or like 20 sticks that were bound together. And he took all these sticks and he put them all together, and he wanted to show his class how strong he was. And he couldn't break the sticks, you know. And he was a little embarrassed in front of his class because he was, you know, trying to talk about how big he was. And one of the boys in the back says, "I can break them." He said, "You can?" He said, "Yeah, I can break them. Can I try it?" He goes, "Sure, come up here." So the other boy comes on up, and he pulls out one stick, breaks it, takes another stick, breaks it. What he did is he just unbound them and broke them all individually, you know? And isn't that like us? That's what the Lord wants to bind us together. We're bound together. It's pretty hard to break. But if he divides us and we all got our own different things that we're so concerned about, he can easily break us. So I think the idea is God fights opposition through a sensible plan. Really, that includes all of us. All right, so a lot of opposition going on. And another one that we get into in chapter 4 is, even a fox will break down that wall. Or a bunch of ridicule. You guys aren't really doing a very good idea, very, very good job, and all that kind of stuff. So they get all this difficulty from the outside, but then it starts happening from the inside as well. And there's poor people among them, and different Jews are actually hurting other Jews. They're charging them interest, and they're really, really not helping them. So it shifts from external problems to internal problems right at home. And Nehemiah has to address that whole thing as well. And we see him praying throughout the book, but he also had to fight greed in others. Because the people were greedy enough to be taking advantage of their own people. Moving on to chapter 6, he has to guard what God had given them. Part of what the enemies were doing were opposing God's work, and what God was calling Nehemiah to do was to guard God's work. And we see this this whole opposition happening over and over and over again in a variety of ways. And I think you know exactly what I'm talking about. And so we need to guard God's work, guard what he's actually done. And Nehemiah had to do it. He had to guard the threats against the city. Some of the people were guarding the gates, and others guarded their homes. But they had to hold a weapon in one hand, he said, and they had to hold a shovel in the other. They had to both protect themselves and work together. So how should you respond to God's faithfulness to restore you? What we see in the first 7 chapters is to serve God diligently. But then it leads to worship. We need to worship God diligently as well. And that is going to be the proper response to God's faithfulness to restore you. So that's what we see in the emphasis when you get into Nehemiah 8. They do finally build the wall, and actually it only takes them 52 days to build the wall. Amazing, less than 2 months. But having the wall built is not sufficient. And a lot of churches have seen this. A lot of churches have built a building and then afterwards divided. Had a church split right after a building project. I don't know if you guys have seen that happen. That's a very common thing. Because all that outside opposition, yeah, we got to get this thing done. They finally get it all done, and then they turn on one another, and people really needed revival. And so the reading of the law brought about a revival in Nehemiah 8. It brought about a conviction of sin, so that people end up confessing their sin, and then they sign a covenant with God, chapters 8, 9, and 10. They needed this to be God actually doing his work in their hearts. And so there's a covenant renewal that takes place as a result of all of that. Leaders need to lead and commitment to God. And same, of course, is true today. And God is the one who actually does it all, though. And chapter 11, here's the key idea, I think, of chapter 11. Make your commitment to God practical by following his individual plan for you. We see that the people, it's all, the city's rebuilt, the walls are rebuilt, but a lot of people, really, most people didn't want to live inside Jerusalem. So they actually have to take up a lot to find out who's actually supposed to live in the city now. It's the opposite of what we experience mostly today. Today, most of us don't want to live in the countryside. We see the world moving toward the cities. There, it was like, oh, who wants to live in a city? It's just overcrowded and more expensive, etc. I want to live in the countryside. But they had to follow whatever the lot said, whatever the, you know, if it said you're going to live in the city, your family going to live in the city, then they agreed to do that. And so we see the resettlement happening in chapters 11 and 12. The walls are all built, and they decide, hey, let's have a big celebration here. So one group starts on the west side. They go south and go on up along the city wall, and another group goes to the north, and they meet at the temple. This amazing procession as they go up on top of the wall, and they're just rejoicing in how God has been faithful. The book ends in chapter 13, where we've got Nehemiah's leadership is highlighted again. They end up having a huge problem of intermarriage. Does that sound familiar? Same problem 13 years earlier under Nehemiah. I mean, under Ezra. And remember what Ezra did? If we're looking at models here, intermarriage led Ezra to pull out his own hair. But we see in Nehemiah, intermarriage led Nehemiah to pull out others' hair. So, hey, if the model here, who's this? Yeah, this is Ezra, because he's pulling out his own hair. And who's this? Yeah, this guy be Nehemiah. He's got, go pull out their hair. I'm going to pull out their hair. If we set these guys up as models of leadership, we're in trouble, because we're really talking about two different personalities here. The focus is not the men. The focus is God, and what would your life look like if you more fully, really fully grasp God's restoring hand in your own experience? You know, in this area of serving the Lord, in this area of worshiping the Lord, those are really the two key concepts we find here. And here's the main idea of Nehemiah. Our restoring God deserves diligent service and worship.